The Gamescooler Podcast is a weekly audio show that educates new and experienced gamers about the awesomeness of tabletop gaming. In this week's episode, we'll cover Pirate's Cove, our game of the week, discuss tips for getting the most out of a convention in the School of Gaming, and wrap it up by revealing our High Five Second Edition games. Welcome to the Gamescooler Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Kotecki, along with my co-host, Dr. Michael McCabe. How's it going, Michael?
Going great, Doug. How are you?
Well, somewhere there's a chicken with its head cut off that's feeling lazy compared to how I've been running around. Just craziness lately. But
now,
that's good.
Self-inflicted. Are you doing that on your own volition? Yes, that's where I was going.
Yes.
Knowing you and how you like to take on projects this time of year. I would assume that you are choosing some of that. Is that accurate or am I being rude?
No, it's 100%. I start to nest in the spring, like get everything in order. I got all these house projects and things I want to get wrapped up and done and try and finish one before I start the next one. But that's not always the case. Why bother with that?
That can be a challenge, right?
How about you? How are things over there?
No, things are good, man. I don't want to get too deep in the personals. I know that you had some dental work done. I've recently also had some not fun dental work done. But as a weekly podcaster and a middle-aged weekly podcaster, we must continue.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't take a week off just because I'm missing a few teeth in the old mouth, right?
Yeah.
You gotta just keep going forward and knowing that things are going to be on the up. I have a little bit of follow-up. Are we okay to just jump right in?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, dearest listeners, unfortunately, we did not get nominated for Podcast of the Year. I know the Golden Geek nominees are out, so if you did vote for us, thank you. And that also entitles you to vote for others. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for, but I've already put mine in for Podcast of the Year. Next year, I'll do a better job of shameless promotion and go after it. I was hoping to see the Family Gamers on there as well. I did see a handful of the podcasts that I listen to regularly that did get nominated, so congratulations to all of them. And the Games of the Year, man, I'm going to have to take some time on that, Doug, because
I didn't even look at it.
The art project not up for presentation and art? Like Vincent Dutrait's art in the art project, I thought, oh, that's a slam dunk. That's going to get on it.
Yeah.
So more to come over the next week or so because the Golden Geeks do kind of start that entry into award season and convention season. And it's fun. It's a fun part of the hobby to just talk about and speculate. And that was my one thing to follow up on.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it now. I haven't looked at it before, but I am fascinated by the way that really is a glimpse through the looking glass of the way that the Board Game Geek users view things and what they consider heavy and light and medium weight and things like that. It's quite the microcosm of...
And this year, I don't know about years past, but this year, if I put up a game for light game of the year, and if it was at like a 2-3 or a 2-4 or a 2-5... it would tell me that, like, hey, are you sure this is a light game? It's rated at a complexity of 2.3.
Yeah.
Basically telling me, or like, maybe this should be in medium. So some of those, I'm going to go back and look and see if the users just blew through that. Like, nope, I'm telling you, this is a light game.
I confirm this is for three-year-olds.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a few more follow-up, but I don't want to just hijack. One other thing, you know, I've shared with listeners in the past, and our listeners who really, I would say, are Friday listeners. You know, as soon as the episode drops, they're listening to it, and they're in the Discord, and it's just like, man, these people make me feel good.
10:30 Central Time it drops, 10:35, they already have comments in Discord.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love it. There's a game that I'm pretty good at. At least I thought I was pretty good at it until I played not only some of our listeners on Board Game Arena I then got trounced so badly by our fellow listeners on Board Game Arena that I then went out and played against other people in the world, like a lot in the last week, and Super Mega Lucky Box by Phil Walker Harding and Game Right. You know, I could consistently, if I'm playing at home against my family, score 55 to 59 and feel good about
Mop up that 8-year-old.
And my wife, I have been getting crushed, Doug, and I'm seeing all these different strategies of like, whoa, you're going to spam the moons and make sure that I finish in second place and lose 6 points? And you're going to just get all the star bonuses? And so it's one of those things where I love that about the hobby, where I can be very confident because my sample size is so small. Like you said, yeah. I'm playing against an 8-year-old and my wife, right?
Yeah.
And we'll play that game. That's one of the games that's been in our home rotation of games over the last 15 months or so. And then you get out there and you play against other people and just get trounced.
Yeah.
So a lot of big healthy dose of humility in this board gamer over the last 7 to 8 days.
Does it change your feeling about the game?
No, I love that game, man.
Yeah.
No, not at all. No. I mean, you know how I am as a competitor. So I've had to try a few different things lately. But no, it doesn't.
I mean, I have to
changes my self-esteem.
Well, yeah, okay.
But
it's
probably a good thing too.
I always struggle with that, of just the idea of like, I want to be conscious of like, I got destroyed, and not letting that affect my opinion of the game. And it can be pretty hard sometimes to overcome that, for me anyway.
In the first game on Board Game Arena in the Game Schooler podcast fan club group, whatever it was, you know, so it was a 4-player game. Doug, I didn't just lose close, okay? This was a blowout of epic proportions. This was like, for any basketball fans, you're down by 37 at halftime. Okay, where do you go from here?
Yeah.
It was one of those moments. So it wasn't, oh, I lost by 4 and I know I'm still really good at that game. No, this was, I got doubled up by multiple
people. Gotta reevaluate my life goals.
Nah, just need to get better at Super Mega Lucky Box.
Yeah.
I'm all right with my life goals at the moment. So that was one.
Yeah, there's been some great discussion on the Discord server about how to handle kids who want to keep playing games instead of moving on to the next task at hand, which I think is interesting. And certainly if that's something that you have an issue with, go on the Discord server and check that out. There's a lot of good, helpful advice from listeners, from Anitra, from the Family Gamers. I put my 2 cents in there. I'm waiting for the good doctor to put his in there.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll weigh in directly publicly on that, and not public, but I've been thinking about that comment a lot. You know, when as a former educator and now current bureaucrat, I'm really careful about weighing in on homeschool questions,
yeah,
because I don't know the learner, the individual learner.
Sure.
You know, so as a gamer and as a dad and as someone who helps run a board game club occasionally at a local middle school, I want to say, game all day long. But then as an educator in somebody, you know, who went through homeschooling a 4-year-old during the pandemic, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, you know your kid.
Yeah.
So I'll jump back in. I've been thinking about that one probably way too much, but
well, and then
set a boundary, follow through with the boundary. And but ultimately, you know your kid.
Yeah.
And but at what I think the gem of the question, and this is where I get too deep and maybe a little nerdy in it, at what point does it go from a game and skills to the same thing as a video game?
Yeah.
Where, no, I just want to play this game all day long.
Yeah.
Just get away from me. I'm having fun. Can't you see it's educational? And so, I don't know. You know your kiddo. You know your setting. I am very reluctant to ever give advice to a homeschool setting, though. I have a lot to learn there in the homeschool, unschool, game school.
Well,
setting, even though we're in the game schooling podcast zone here.
Yeah. But I think,
does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think it also goes without saying that it's like everybody parents different, everybody's kids are different. And so any of those things are going to have to be taken as a broad generalization as best as possible. I mean,
yeah,
my wife and I have very different parenting styles and how we get the kids ready for school or how we get the kids to bed at night, you know, whatever it is, you know, and that's just two people that are in the same relationship parenting the same kids that have differences, let alone certainly I've got no business telling anybody else how to raise their kids or what they want to do as far as that goes. And like you said, it is a fine line between if it's working great, keep it going. And but we can't spend all day on this, right? So yeah. Shuffling there. And if you've got opinions or ideas, let's put it that way, ideas on things that have worked for you in the past. And I think that's what I kind of threw in there, things that I've done in the past to help with that. Go on the Discord server and, you know, chime in on that one, gameschooler.com/Discord. I want to thank, and we probably don't do this enough, but I do want to thank the folks who are listening every week and who spend the time interacting with one another on Discord. I really appreciate that, and it just means a lot to us that there's a community growing and people helping out, whether it's, you know, a place to unload a game that's not working for your family anymore to another family that's excited about it, to sharing the little victories of a kid teaching the game for the first time or winning for the first time and how to handle losing and all the things that come up with parenting and gaming with kids and trying to navigate our own nerdiness as we acquire more games and play more stuff. So heartfelt thank you for everybody that's participating in that. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, that's nice, Doug. And what I've noticed, I don't go on Facebook anymore, like at all. That my Facebook time has been replaced by the Discord time, and Facebook is where I really used to connect with educators from my life, friends, and I'm just like, I get a lot of that out of our Discord too, because we have so many different educators and librarians and parents who are educating their kiddos.
Counselors.
So, that's a great call out, Doug.
Yep. The last little follow up I have before we move on to what's awesome in gaming is, don't forget about the website, gameschooler.com. So there's, every once in a while we like to do general reminders, but there's a lot of good resources on there. And certainly all of the games of the week are in there in a nice list and database. You can go and see the cover, a little description, and tells you some of the skills that we've talked about on the show when we're talking about those games. So don't be shy checking that out and using that as a resource, especially if you're looking for something new to try out. You can sort it on the side by playtime, player count, ages, all those type of things to maybe help you find a good game to try out. So
awesome.
All right, Michael, what's awesome in gaming this week?
Well, I've got at least one thing. How about you?
Well, I've got my what's on the shelf. So I've got that. I did a little tease in the Discord with the Mr. Magoo blurry picture.
Go ahead. All right. Go ahead. You lead us into that.
All right. So this week's games in a cube on my Calyx. We discussed last week two of them, Tokaido and Nemiji. And shout out to Sean, who got 3 out of 5, which I thought was pretty impressive for the blurriness. But Tokaido and Nemiji, check out last episode if you want to learn more about those. The next in the list is Quantum, which is a cool space game in which you're using dice as your ships, and the number of pips facing up on the dice is the type of ship that it is. So one moves faster than a six, but a six is way more powerful, and it can't move as fast. And, you know, they all have different abilities as you move around, and you're trying to stake claims throughout the universe around planets in order to win points. So that's a pretty cool game. It's been a while since I played it, and I'd like to get that back to the table at some point.
We should play it. I love that game.
The next one is a really cool one that I always have a good time with, and I think I'm interested to try. Is it Expeditions of the World? Is that the one coming out from Hachette?
Yes, that Hachette's coming out with. Yeah,
it has. This next game has a very similar feel to that, but it seems like it might be a little bit more streamlined. But the one on my shelf is called Isla Dorado. And this is a game where you have places on the board that you want to go to, and there is only one player piece. and people are bidding on where to move the player piece in order to try and meet their objectives. And so there's the bidding and trying to negotiate and sway people to move in a direction that may be helpful for you. So it's a pretty cool game. It's an older one, but I've always enjoyed that one. And the last one is Professor Evil and the Citadel of Time. And that is a cooperative game in which Professor Evil has stolen a lot of the historic landmarks of the world, world wonder type things. And you need to go around his mansion and try and recover those before it's too late by locking doors, opening, not falling into traps, all that type of thing. And it's a cool little game also by Funforge, same people that do Tokaido and Nemiji. So that's what's on my shelf this week.
Awesome. That Expeditions game, Wolfgang Kramer?
Sounds right, yeah.
And it looks like it's a 1996 game that's getting a fresh coat of paint on it. Yeah. Expeditions around the world.
Yeah,
so it kind of fits right into some of our high five themes from the last couple weeks with new and different and wonderful second editions. So,
all right. What's awesome for you, Michael?
Cool. Well, Doug, do you ever have, and this wasn't my family growing up. I'm Irish Catholic, you know, but did you ever have somebody that was in your house so much that maybe they became an uncle?
Hmm.
Did you ever have, was that in your family or culture growing up?
I did not.
Central Illinois. That's Uncle Michael. He's not really your uncle, but sure, he's here so much he's your uncle.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like anyone who's watched The Sopranos knows what I'm talking about, mm-hmm, right? Well, in our house this past week, I do believe we have Uncle Reiner. I think Dr. Reiner Canizia has become so well known. Beloved might be too strong of a word.
Beloved.
But whatever, beloved, he's an uncle. Because I got a chance to play Sunrise Lane with my wife, and I talked about this in a previous episode. It's a game that was published by Horrible Guild that came out just last year that I played with my 8-year-old. But just with how that game unfolded and it got the seal of approval in the house, there were so many different Reiner Canizia mentions from Sunday through yesterday. You know, we had a board game club thrown in there, had a game of Llama thrown in there, and I think it was like the 40th logged game of Llama that it played. So thank you for introducing me and my family to Llama.
Oh, you're welcome.
But I got to tell you, Uncle Reiner has some, and some more games are going to be coming.
Yeah, just stop by the 25th Century booth at Origins. There's like, started going through the Origins preview, and there's 12 Reiner Canizia games coming out from 25th Century.
Yeah, and that Cascadero and Cascadito is going to be delivered, like within the next 24 hours to my house. So through the desert as well, a re-implementation from Allplay. So just thought I'd share that. Thought our listeners would get a nice little kick out of that too, that, you know, awesome in gaming. We've had other designers, Sir Richard Garfield, Phil Walker Harding, certainly a Game Schooler Hall of Fame. I think if we had a Game Schooler Hall of Fame, they'd be in there. But Reiner is in a new category from being laughed at and joked to Uncle Reiner.
Oh, respected and loved.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah. Well, he's got a seat at the table. You know, whenever he wants, if he's in town, stop by, yeah. Uncle Reiner.
All right. Well, we'll see if we can get that message to him. Next time he's...
I think he just got it.
Well.
I think he's a loyal
listener.
I don't know about loyal, but I feel like, and since he's an uncle, I think I could be this honest. There's probably a Google alert
for
his name on his computer. And the amount of times I just said Reiner Canizia.
He's got like a bad signal that goes off every time somebody says his name
throughout the world. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a Google alert set for charter schools and Wisconsin, just so I can keep up on what's going on in my day job and keep abreast. And I'm sure that Reiner Canizia has a Google alert set for Reiner Canizia.
Yeah, world alert.
So.
All right. reminder, sign up for the Discord, gameschooler.com/Discord. Great community there. Spread the word about the podcast. If you know Reiner Knizia, let him know that we talked about him this week. And if you have any questions or comments, reach out to us. Email at gameschooler.com. Again, email at gameschooler.com. Let's move on to the game of the week.
The game of the week. The game of the week is an in-depth look at a family-friendly game we think you should try if you get the chance. This week's game is Pirate's Cove. Doug, give us the stats.
All right. Published in 2002 by Days of Wonder, the designers are Paul Randles and Daniel Stahl. And as I was getting this information, I wanted to look up to see what other games they may have designed. Unfortunately, Paul Randles passed away shortly after the publishing of this game, and Daniel Stahl only has this game credited to him.
Yeah,
the art is by Cyril Dujon. 3 to 5 players, about 60 minutes, may go a little bit longer. 8+, according to the box, 8+, according to Board Game Geek. I'm probably going to put it up in the 10 just to deal.
That's where I was going to go to.
Just to deal with some of the take that shows up in this game. But that being said, it's still a family game. The game has 12 turns. And at the start of every turn, each pirate must decide secretly which of the 6 islands they will visit. All players reveal their navigation direction simultaneously, and then the turn is resolved. If any 2 or more pirates end up at the same island, combat ensues. Combat resolution is determined by the strengths of your ship and the results of cannon fire, which are determined by dice. The goal of combat is to scare away rival pirates so that you are the only pirate left at the island. If you stay in combat too long, your ship will suffer more... will suffer and make subsequent turns more difficult. So there is a fine balance of when to stay and fight and when to let the bigger ship have its booty. If you flee from combat, you end up at Pirate's Cove, where you receive a small compensation for the turn. Once all conflicts are resolved, the bounty for each island is given out. Each island except Pirate's Cove and Treasure Island offer various amounts of fame, which are the victory points in this game, gold, which you use to upgrade your ship, and treasure, which you hold on your ship, but then you bury at Treasure Island, or tavern cards, which give you special abilities and bonuses throughout the game. The bounty is skewed so that some islands are clearly better choices than others, so it can force you to decide for or bluff.
Or so you think.
If you think you can take the island, should other pirates go after the same bounty? Once you have your bounty, you can purchase upgrades for your ship. Each island offers a different ship component. The 4 parts of your ships are sails, which determine the speed and initiative in combat. The hull, how much treasure you can carry. Crew is needed to man the cannons. And cannons, the lower number of your crew or cannons determines how many dice you roll in combat. There's also an island with a pub that offers useful strategy cards to help you in all aspects of the game. Last island is Treasure Island, in which offers no real bounty other than the chance to bury treasure that you have in your hull. And bury treasure is converted into fame, and that's a 1-to-1. So for every treasure you drop off at Treasure Island, you get 1 fame. The game ends after 12.
How do you win the game?
Whoever has the most fame at the end of 12 rounds is the winner of the game. And one of the things I really like about this game is that all of the elements make sense. You need to upgrade your sails. That allows you to fire first in combat if you're in that situation. Your cannons and crew, whichever is lower, determines how many dice you roll. So that's great that you have 5 cannons, but if you only have 2 crew to fire them, you're only going to be able to fire two cannons. And then the cargo hold. So you have that kind of basicness, and then wrapped up in a fun combat system. When you fight another pirate, you roll dice, and then the other pirate is hit on rolls of 5s or 6s, in which their ship, which is a player mat marked off by little rings highlighting which level you're at, you, for every hit you move down, you kind of choose which part of the other your opponent's ship you want to attack. So say I want to attack Michael's hull, and if I hit him twice, his hull is going to go down by 2 points. If it ever goes off the board, he's crippled and has to go to Pirate's Cove to repair his ship. All the other islands allow you to upgrade those components. So if I'm on the crew island, I can upgrade that crew at the end of the round. So it's one of those things that's really easy to teach in practice, and you're kind of up and going in no time. And I think part of that is because of the how well the mechanisms and the thematic ties connect to one another, that it makes sense.
Let's back up real quick. Doug, what is the essence of this game? Like, if you had to just put it in a one-line description, because it's a three, it fits a few different places, but as a game that's over 20 years old, as a game that only plays from 3 to 5 players, what is the essence of this game, Pirate's Cove?
Well, it's one of the rare games that actually feels like a pirate game. It feels like you are on the open seas, traveling to different islands to accomplish your goals, and you are running into competitor pirates, and you need to fight each other or walk away. There is, depending on the number of players, there are one or more legendary pirates that are out there that are blocking islands, and you can choose to go there, but they're very powerful. Very powerful.
Yeah, this is a pirate game.
Pirates,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is the essence. This is a pirate adventure.
And a family
fight,
way one.
Or you're going to force. Yeah. Or you're going to bluff like you're going to fight so that other people fight, and you're going to get an advantage somewhere else. I have had so much fun playing this game that when we were at Gen Con last year, Gen Con has a flea market, basically like a giant garage sale. And this was my gem from Gen Con 2023. Doug found a copy of Pirate's Cove and put it in the air in victory pose, like, Michael. And I ran and got that thing and was happy to bring it home because of the gameplay. It is a game that fits so well with skirmishing and battling and leveling up a ship. And then, oh man, my ship got destroyed in this area. So what am I going to do to try to make it better? How do I get this treasure over to Treasure Island? Can I get to Treasure Island for a second time? Do I need to get to Treasure Island for a third time to win? And all of those pieces that are happening. The other thing that I really like about it is the amount of hidden information that's in the game as well.
Yeah.
When you go to the tavern and you get cards, those cards are secret. I mean, there could be a little parrot that basically helps the captain on the ship.
Yeah.
But people don't know if I have 1 point buried or if I have 6 or 7 points buried.
Yeah.
And for a game that is over 20 years old, the points are pretty tight.
Yeah.
I mean, that game is pretty close at the end.
Yeah.
So that's my rant about what I like about it before you even ask the question what I like about it. There's just so many different pieces that I love. I'm a sucker for pirate games.
Yeah.
But this pirate game, unlike a lot of other ones, the race in it is different. The race is to build up my ship so that I can hold treasure and get the treasure out before other people see it. But it also has that the piece in where if people see that I'm successful, I'm prone to a fight, right?
Well, if they can guess where you're going. And I think that's one of the things that this game can be mean, but I think what works for it is that the meanness is unintentional for the most part. Somebody can make a guess on thinking what island you might go to, and they can guess wrong, or they can guess right, or maybe they're going there for their own reasons. And it's like, you can try and pick a battle, but you don't know if it's going to happen. And I think that's one of the things that it comes down to, where it's like, it's almost that double bluff. It's like, I think he's going to go there. And then the other person's like, they probably think I'm going to go there, so I better not go there. And then you end up going to the same island, and it becomes kind of this, oh, shucks type of thing, as opposed to I'm getting beat up on purpose. So
I wish that's the language you would have used last time we played, Doug.
Yeah.
Oh, shucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a lot milder than the language that was thrown across the table.
Maybe.
It is
Well, and I was just going to say that so I think it is mean, but I think the meanness is cut in half. However, there is one caveat that every time I've played this, first time players usually get wary after their first battle, which usually happens somewhere within the first three rounds. And I think they think that it's unrecoverable. Like, oh my gosh, I just lost in battle. This game is over. I'm just getting beat up on. And every time I've played this, the scores end up within 5 or 6 points of each other, and nobody is ever out of it. I think I lost by 5 or 6 points the last game, and I think I lost every battle I was in.
No, that's a great point. It's similar to Quacks of Quedlinburg, where if you bust in an early round, that's not as catastrophic as if you bust in the last round. And I feel like in Pirate's Cove, if you lose a battle, the first battle, you can recover. The second battle, you can recover. But that last battle, that last showdown with either another player or a legendary pirate, oh, you feel that even more. And I regarding the meanness, it's a pirate game.
Yeah.
If I'm playing a pirate game, guess what? I'm going to be a scoundrel. I'm going to compete. I'm going to try to get the most gold. I'm going to try to take your gold. It's a pirate game. I don't want to do math and math out a pirate game.
Yeah.
I want to be a pirate. I want to look at my ship. I want to look at your ship across the table. I want to make a decision if I can take out your ship or I want to run.
Yeah.
You know, and I like that about Pirate's Cove. The wooden dice, the components, really hard to believe that this is a game that's over 20 years old, just with how it looks on the table and how it still kind of pops. The player mats are I would say they're dare I say, cute, but it all really just works well.
Yeah. The it's easy to teach, and that combat system is fun. There is a level of, you know, you can roll. And I think that's why you never really feel out of it, is that, you know, we had a couple of battles in the last time we played, and you were rolling 6 dice against my 3. And I still hung on for 3 or 4 rounds.
Didn't feel like it.
It just doesn't, you know, it's like sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And that randomness is in such a good, used to such good effect in this game.
Yeah.
That matches the lighthearted nature of it. There's not a lot of, oh man, I spent all game building up this thing and then it got destroyed by some, you know, it's like the whole thing is random. There's a lot of chaos going on, and for me it's that right balance of and control and chaos. Don't like too much just random chaos, and I certainly don't like chaos when I think I should have more control or the illusion of control. And this is like, stuff's happening, you know. You thought you're gonna land safely on that island. Nope, you're not. We're gonna have a duel, and sometimes slinking away is not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, and if you slink away before you actually take a hit, do you want to tell our listeners about the mutiny, or are we getting too far into the Pirate's Cove weeds here?
It's a little bit in the weeds, but yes, if you do take decide to flee before any combat has engaged, you have to roll a die, and if you roll a 1, you have a mutiny, which you lose all the treasure on board and some
You're
fame
done.
Points. It's not very delightful when that happens.
And I like the battle with just the 5 and the 6s as a hit and the mutiny as a 1 out of 6 chance, because I feel like both of those design choices engage the mathletes in the crowd, right? Sometimes, especially some of the newer Euros or other dice placement games, they don't encourage engagement. They just it feels like a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
With the Pirate's Cove, it's like, I have 6 dice. Doug has 3 over there. My 33% chance with these 6 dice should be a lot better than his 33%, but it's not working for me. And it keeps me in that fight in a way that some of the more recent games don't all the time. They almost encourage too much math. And I don't know if that's making sense, I do get that feeling when I'm playing
it. It's a little bit like the Catan type of thing where, yes, I'm on a space that should be firing off more statistically. And this game, for whatever reason, this time it's not. But at the same time, every time somebody rolls a die, there's a chance it could happen. Which is like, even though I'm rolling 3 dice against Michael's 6, it's like, I could knock them out if all three of these were fives and sixes with one roll, you know, and so there is that excitement from turn to turn. I think this is a great family game night with kids who can handle the fighting aspect. So that's where, to me, you don't really necessarily go into that eight or I think 10 is probably where it starts to emotionally handle this. Now, of course, every kid's unique. Throw that out there. And you would know as the parent of your child where they're at. But I would gear towards the older. And I think it's also a great game for a game group to kind of let off some steam and just kind of break up the monotony. If you're playing a brain-burning game, this has that right balance of engagement but fun and randomness, which is hard to find.
Yeah, I would also peg this as a perfect convention game if this is in a library. And we should send a message on Geek Chat or to the designer and just let him know, hey, we talked about your game. We love your game because it's the game that he's designed.
Yeah.
But I can't in good faith tell people go out and spend $80 or $90 to get. But if you come across this at a convention, the other thing that I really like about the rule book is from a different era.
Yeah.
The rule book is from that Catan era where every single card is explained. And Doug, I got to tell you, I actually like that.
Yeah.
I like looking in and seeing a full description of the four parrots and not having to guesstimate of, well, is it may or is it must? And
parrots
then a description of what happens if what happens if your parrot gets shot off of your shoulder. A very detailed description. And but that being said, if you find yourself at a convention with other gamers, I definitely think that this is a game that can be figured out and set up and played by gamers fairly quickly. What are you laughing at, man?
At a convention with other gamers. So if you go to a quilting convention, probably not the best place to...
Hey, why don't you get out of my head there and come back into the conversation where I'm at. If you're at a board game convention and this is sitting in a library...
There you go.
I'm saying you should be able to pick it up and play the game.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were a quilter, Doug. But well, I know where your home projects have taken you over the last week or so.
I just wanted to know what other conventions gamers, you know, would be at that you'd be playing this game. So I thought that was interesting. So as far as some skills, certainly the decision making, which island to go to, whether you want to flee, that type of stuff. Observation plays a big part in this game, looking around to see where you think other people may or may not be going. Resilience, kind of getting over that first battle.
That was the one I was going to bring.
Win yep. or loss. There's tactical thinking in making those decisions, and certainly competition throughout this game. Any that you want to highlight specifically, Michael?
Yeah, the resilience. Yeah. I think those early battles and even sometimes the unintentional battles. And obviously, Doug and I play a lot of games. We play a lot of games together. But there can be that quote-unquote awesome turn, like, oh, I'm gonna go upgrade my ship and then I'll be able to carry the full treasure, and then I find myself in a fight and suddenly that plan is scrapped and you just have to have that resilience. But I think it's in a great way. The other one is the resource management, and it really has to do with how much treasure am I able to keep versus how many dice am I able to chuck that will help me in a battle.
Yeah.
And just making those decisions about where you're going to manage your resources on your ship, because there's just the four things you got to keep track of, right? There's the speed of your ship. There's how many crew, how many cannons, and how much treasure. But balancing all that is just a delightful decision. I wish I played this game as a teenager, you know, 15, 17, 19, 20-year-old, and could just kind of see if... I'd love to see myself as a younger human playing it, compared to somebody who was introduced in middle age. But yeah. I still think there's a ton of really good skills and just a good old fun time.
Yeah.
It's a good fun fight.
Well, and you kind of, we haven't talked about this, but you kind of want to build up your ship evenly, because if you don't, yep. you've got a weak spot on your ship that's where everybody's going to attack if you happen to get into combat. So you kind of want to build everything up a little bit even, because your weakest spot is exactly what they're going after.
Why are you picking on my cannons again?
Yeah.
The last person just picked on my cannons.
Yeah, and Michael said this one is long out of print, and I have no idea if it would ever be reprinted based on the designer situation. But it is one that I think is probably in a lot of game libraries and kind of stashed away in a lot of game stores and in their libraries as well.
Yeah, I did try to pick it up in trade for a long time before I picked it up at Gen Con last year. There's currently 11,000 people that on BoardGameGeek that own it.
Yeah.
And it is for trade worldwide by 436 people and want in trade by 259. And that's just a stat that I look at. If that were completely upside down, I don't think we'd be talking about it. And Noble Knight currently has one copy for $30, which, you know, that's wrong. It's actually $80 when I clicked on a Noble Knight.
Yeah.
They have the German version published by Amigo, Pirates Cove, which is Piratenbucht for $30. But if you want the Days of Wonder version, you're going to pay $80.
Yeah.
Which is funny because
we look at that and say, oh, $80. But that's what games are starting to go for now.
Yeah.
It's not outlandish as it was before. And I kind of think about to myself, it's like, no. If you play it in a convention, do you want to take a chance on two $40 games that you don't know, or play it in convention and then say, yeah, this is worth two $40 games, and I'm going to take a chance on it, you know? So,
well, and it's one that I think I'll probably put up to play at our local convention every other year.
Yeah.
Right. And run a game, and I'll put very clear descriptors. Do not eat the brisket walking tacos and then come play my out-of-print game. Like, I'm going to be really clear with what you can and cannot bring to the table for this because I want to keep my copy mint. But
yeah.
I have one other thing to say before we move on,
sure.
If that's all right.
Yep.
So that I did some research because I thought if we're going to tell the story, I really want to tell the story. And on BoardGameGeek, some of the most recent posts, you know, you get the gamers who are talking about, oh, there's a runaway leader problem. Yeah. Possibly, maybe that was just one time you played.
Yeah.
I think if somebody gets out to a lead in the games that I've played, they're getting in fights and it gets balanced out.
Yeah.
So that's one if you're looking and discerning of if you want to invest in the game. But I thought this was really interesting. There's a solo mode that I'm going to go back and play here over the next, I don't know, month or so. But it's called the Loathsome Red Dread.
Is that fan-created?
Full solo mode. Yeah, that is fan-created. That somebody put a file page and a PDF version out there. And I thought, I'm going to go check that out. Because right now, in my solo time, I'm actually going through Dead Reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
John D. Clare's 4X. Very different pirate adventure.
Yes.
So that's one that I'll follow up on later. Certainly in the next, before Gen Con. I'll hopefully get it to the table and do a solo mode of the Loathsome Red Dread. So I thought that was cool.
All right. Well, that is going to do it for our game of the week. That is Pirate's Cove from Days of Wonder.
The School of Gaming. In the School of Gaming, we discuss concepts, keywords, etiquette, and helpful ideas in the world of gaming. This week, we're going to discuss tips for getting the most out of a convention.
Yeah, so this was a question from Nils when we were asking for some ideas for School of Gaming segments. And so it is what it says, tips for getting the most out of a convention. I will start by saying something that is becoming my kind of go-to thing for this podcast, and that is intentions. Setting expectations about why you're going to a convention and what you want to get out of it are important. And it comes up with gaming, and certainly I think it goes a long way in getting the most out of a convention is knowing why you're going there. People get excited about, oh, Gen Con or this, or I want to go to a convention, or people talk about how much fun they have at conventions or things like that. And it's like, then you just need to clarify and solidify that with yourself of why you want to go. Is it to play games? Is it to go shopping? Is it to try a whole bunch of games and demo? Is it just to be around other people that enjoy the same things that you do? I think that's one of the easiest ways to get the most out is by being clear going in so that you don't have a disconnect afterwards.
It's funny because sometimes we are so similar and sometimes we are so far apart. And this week we're on the similar side. My key word is purpose. What is the purpose of the convention? And then as I was looking at the question and framing the question, I thought about a Punnett square, a little two by two square where work and play are on one side and self or group are on the other side, and then putting the purpose somewhere in that square. If I'm going for, you know, I really do want to talk about this because I think a lot of people who go to conventions in some way, shape, or form, they're working in the industry somewhere. I don't know the percentage, but I mean, you think about the conventions or game days that we have gone to and the familiar faces, the repeated faces that we see over and over. A lot of times it's because they're working there. So that answer would be very different than I think the play. If you're going to play and be a part of that convention, and even sometimes for us as hosts of the Game Schooler podcast, I have to answer that question differently. Yep. And then the next one is, am I going by myself or am I going with a group? And a group can be just one other person. And that really takes me into the part of the square of being able to be flexible and prioritize and then running back towards that purpose. Yep. If I'm going individually, the level of flexibility can be, oh, that game looks cool. Squirrel, I'm going to go over there, sit down and play. Versus if I'm going with a group, with you or with one of my kiddos or with multiple people, I really need to have a different level of flexibility so that the entire group can engage in that convention.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's really important is the idea of don't overdo it. And I think I put in parentheses the idea of pretend that you'll go to another convention at some point in your life and you don't need to fit it all in one day. And I think there is a situation of being overwhelmed. I don't know when I'll be back at Gen Con. I don't know when I will go to this convention again. And as a result, you get up early and you stay up way too late and then do that four times in a row. And I think if you just pretend that you're going next year, just assume that you're going next year, even if you aren't, and just kind of take it one step at a time and don't overwhelm yourself, I think that goes a long way of having a good experience.
That's a good point.
There are folks that go and they just run themselves ragged and then they talk about like they need a week to recover. And then I'm thinking, to me, it's a lot like getting plastered at some point where it's just like, yeah, but if the whole next day is ruined, was that worth it type of a thing? And I think just
for folks who aren't from the Midwestern United States, Doug just made a reference to being inebriated, imbibing in too much liquor. We had a little slang slip into the podcast, so I just wanted to clarify. Back to you, Doug.
So I think, you know, yes, you can maximize and you can get a whole bunch of games played, but at what expense, you know? And
well, and you and I have fallen into that trap,
yeah.
You know, along the way, and budgeting time, budgeting money, and budgeting relaxation or rejuvenation. I think all three of those things are very key for me as I head into a convention because I can get overwhelmed. And you know, I'm an individual who is also prone to migraine headaches and will sometimes, I'm okay. I'm at the convention. I can sit down. I can take another rules teach. I could take another demo. And like being able to know myself and be able to say, hey, I've got about 30 minutes and I'm going to have to tag out and go eat a burger or just chill for a minute. I'm getting a little overwhelmed because what is overwhelming for me may not be overwhelming with the people that I'm with. And so that gets into my last point of just being able to communicate and put up boundaries, which can be, if I'm as an individual, it's easy, right? I can just go in my car and sit for 15 minutes and catch my breath. But with a group, that is a challenge for me because I don't want to take away the fun from the rest of the group. But that process of setting boundaries and just communicating with people of where I'm at is something that I continue to get better at as I get older. But it's something that I can also not do a very good job of in the convention setting, right? Because I'm conscious of other people have invested time, money, and effort. And I want to make sure that I'm not hampering their good time.
Yeah.
So,
well, and I think we did, you know, if you look back at last year for us is the first time that either of us went to Gen Con, which is the largest game convention in the United States, with so not only was it our first time going, but it was also with the guys of, yeah, we're gamers. We like to play games, and we have this podcast, and we had press badges. And I thought we did a really good job of, like, 6 o'clock, the exhibit hall closed, like, yeah, we're done for the day. We're just going to go back and get something to eat and hang out and kind of be done. And it's like we're getting in our car in the parking lot, and you know that people are still gaming until 7 more hours after that. And they may have got, like, we weren't even getting there to break down the door to get in. I don't even know if we ever got there when it opened. And you know that some people are getting in line 2 hours before, so they can be the first one on the exhibit hall, and then not going to bed until 2 o'clock the next morning, and then waking up again to do that. And I felt like,
well, and that would have been me at 23. Yeah. I mean, you just described what I would have done. And so it goes back to purpose and intentions, right? And a 4-day convention is a marathon versus a 1-day convention could be a sprint where I'm going to go game today for 14 hours because this is what I'm doing on my Saturday. Yeah. This is my day. No, that's a good point. Anything else that you have for this?
Yeah, I mean, I've got some kind of quick ones. Make sure you eat, stay hydrated, that type of stuff, which it's hard to do when there's a lot of fun and exciting things to look at, to make sure you stop and do that. Following up on what you said, take a break if you're overwhelmed. Like, do not feel like you need to suck every last dollar out of the ticket that you paid. If you need to take a break for yourself,
which is hard for gamers.
Yeah, take a break. Don't be too hard on yourself if you're playing a bunch of new games, if you're not picking them up, or if you're losing a bunch of games in a row or whatever. It's like, just take it as an experience, that type of thing. And then if you can, sign up for games that you really want to play, but don't sweat it if you don't. Like, I guess not necessarily don't sweat it if you don't, but like you don't also need to get on that. The games are being released at 10 a.m. sign up. I need to be there immediately to sign up for everything I can and get it. And if I don't, I'm going to be devastated. Like, sign up if you want to. And if you miss out, there's going to be plenty of people to play games with.
Yeah, the other thing that I just wanted to mention, I think conventions are a great opportunity to meet new people and make friends. Yeah. And I know that sounds incredibly cheesy. Like, yeah, that guy must have been a middle school teacher or principal at some point. But in all seriousness, even at Gen Con, we ended up playing Pick a Pepper with a married couple, and they were awesome. Yeah. I was like, man, I could completely sit down and play a 2-3 hour games with this group of people back to back, right? And at our regional convention, I mean, I've got 2 or 3 names and numbers in my phone for when I go back to that regional convention again next year to meet up and play. And I think that is another, that's not necessarily tied to my purpose, but it is part of the hobby, is that if I'm open to playing new games and meeting new people, conventions are a great way to bring this awesome hobby to life, more than just the standard game group and regular people that I play with.
Yeah, no, awesome. Let us know in the Discord server if there's any tips and tricks that you have or have you picked up over the years of going to conventions, or some concerns that you might have if you haven't gone to a convention. And there's going to be some folks in there that that can help address some of those things as well.
Yeah, not to just speak to one listener in case that listener isn't listening, but I know Andrew and Anitra have covered a similar segment, and Anitra has a wonderful hygiene and sleep rule as well. I didn't go back and listen to that, but I know when I think Andrew was getting ready for Essen or a major show, and they talked about kind of their rules.
That,
and
that almost seems like a tip for helping others get the most out of a convention is taking care of yourself so I don't have to smell you at the table. So let us know what kind of tips and tricks you have, and let's move on to the high five. If you're anything like us, you're constantly on the hunt for new games to try out. This week, Michael and I are taking a look at our High Five second edition games. In this, I tried to avoid games that were basically just an art upgrade. I wanted to have something where it was a little bit more that they improved the gameplay or changed something in the gameplay that I thought was better. I do have one that, two of them that are art related, but they made the game easier to play.
Yeah, I went with a similar approach. I also wanted to get games that we haven't just been talking about week in, week out. So they forced me to stretch a little bit. I think coming off our segment last week, stretch maybe so much to the point that I get some grief from you.
Never.
So I'm looking forward to this.
I would never.
You ready for number five? Ooh. And I did not do just all Reiner
Kinesia. Oh, he's got visual aids.
Yeah, but number five for me is a game I haven't actually played yet, but in discerning which one to buy, this is Zuvadis from Reiner Knizia. It was re-implemented from a game called Quo Vadis, which is one of our favorite family sayings in the McCabe house. Quo Vadis means rise and let us be on our way. And in Quo Vadis, it's a negotiation game where you're trying to make your way through the Roman Senate. And I got really excited about the gameplay, really excited about the mechanics. I looked at it at Noble Knight and I said, I cannot take this game home to my house. This is the ugliest game I've... And you know me, I'm not usually going to slam on someone's aesthetics of the game, but I was like, yeah, interesting. A theme that I think that my teenager would love to... I can't do it. And then like within a month from that, the Kickstarter came out for Zuvadis and I was all over it. I was a first day backer. And yeah, I know we haven't actually played it yet, but it's one that I will actually be teaching at a local game convention in October. And I'm excited to play. Maybe I should talk about the actual game, but in Zuvadis, you are negotiating your way through the zoo. So you're wheeling and dealing and you're making your way through the zoo. Has some very interesting negotiation tactics and mechanics, and one that I'm really excited to play with my family. I just need to do some more learning and dive in on it. Twice I've gotten it to the table, I've gotten it set up, but that's where it's like, I don't want to make my family do reviews and nobody else is really excited about it, but it's one I am.
And you also don't like the animals on it, right? That was a disappointment on your end?
It was, but I've gotten over it. I would have preferred people. I really would have, but I think having done a full review of the rules twice now and a full like setup out on the table, the wooden animals and their little individualized bags have started to talk to me. You know, they've got some character and some personality, and I'm over it.
All right. My number five is one that needed an art upgrade, and I think it makes the game so much more immersive, and that is Suburbia, which was originally published in 2012, and this edition came out in 2021. And I'm not talking about the huge collector's edition. They upgraded the art on the regular edition as well. This is by Bezier Games and Ted Alsbach. Suburbia is essentially a SimCity type game, if you're familiar with that old computer game where you're adding residential and commercial and industrial buildings to a city and trying to get them to work together. And the original game came out and I had it, and it was very minimalistic, that almost made it look like a spreadsheet-y type graphic design artwork and was not very immersive. And in the new version, they upgraded the artwork to there's way more colors. The buildings have character and things like that.
The iconography is
great,
too.
Yeah, that I think makes it a lot more immersive to me, feeling like I'm building a city as opposed to mathematically building a city. And so this is the one. Everything else on the list has art, but they've changed it something. This is just kind of a fresh coat of paint that really made a lot of difference for me. So that's my number five, Suburbia.
Excellent choice, Doug. How's that not been a game of the week? A game that we both love? We'll have to look at our stringent criteria.
I got another one on my list. Two actually on my list that I'm surprised we haven't talked about. One I was really, I looked it up on our website and I'm like, we have not talked. How have we not talked about this?
A lot of games up there. Number four on my list, we have talked about just back in episode 152. And I hesitate to bring it up because it was just back in episode 152. But Santa's Workshop.
Oh, yeah.
Y'all, the second edition from Elf Creek. And what they did, too, with the basic version and then like a hobby-level gamer version on both sides of the board. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing because the original artwork was so bad.
No, that's where I was going, but I don't want to get a cease and desist from Rio Grande Games because you trashed them
so much, Doug. I didn't even think of this as a second edition because the other one has just been blocked out of my mind permanently, been black-holed.
Oh, that's funny. No, it's a game that Doug has in his collection. I don't own. I do want my kiddos to be able to play it at some point, and I just absolutely love it, and we talked about it at length in episode 152.
All right. My number four is the only one on my list that we have talked about previously, and that is Seven Wonders. We talked about it way back in episode 28, and this is one where aesthetically the original came out in 2010 and the reprint came in 2020 by Repost Production and Antoine Bauza. This is one that they upgraded the iconography and the artwork that makes it easier to play and kind of follow some of the chains that they did with symbols and things like that over the original version. It's prettier to look at, and they borrowed some of the things that they learned from Seven Wonders Duel and kind of carried some of that forward and brought it back into the original. And I think it makes it easier to play and better to look at while you're doing so. So that is my number four, Seven Wonders.
Oh, that's a good one, Doug. My number three, I apologize, I'm just doing a little bit of research here. The original is, so this is going to be contentious for, I don't want to say neckbeards, but any of our gamers that we have in the crowd. The original is 15th of all time.
Blasphemer.
And the second edition is ranked 29th of all time. And I prefer the second edition, and that's Great Western Trail. And I will tell you, I haven't actually played the first edition, so I guess I'm just piling on here. But Eggert Spiel and the work that they did with the second edition and just the track and how it's set up and laid out and getting your cattle to Kansas City and back, which is what you're doing in Great Western Trail. The second edition has some Chris Quilliam's art in it. The designer is Alexander Pfister, and the publisher is Eggert Spiel. So I should have given some of those stats. It is a hobby level game.
Yeah.
This is a game that it's going to take you 2 hours. And even if you're playing it solo, it's still going to take you 2 hours. And then the setup and takedowns another hour, and the rules refresh is probably another hour. But it's fantastic game. Also available on Board Game Arena. It's out there, one that you could try before you buy. I just think they've done a really good job with the second edition. Good enough where it's going to sit on my shelf. It might not get played for several years because my family is not the right audience for it.
Yeah.
But if I had two or three buddies over, it's just a really solid game. So that's my number three, Great Western Trail.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. That was on my honorable mentions. My number three
must not be that good.
No, it's terrible. I would never put it on my list proper. my number three is a revised edition, and that is Ex Libris, originally published in 2017. The reprint came out in 2023. Renegade Game Studios, Adam P. McIver. What's the matter, Michael?
I think that's a stretch, but I need to hear more about this second edition, revised edition.
Okay, there's a couple of things going on. One of them is they reduce the size of the box, which is huge. It takes up less space. But the big thing is the Ex Libris is a worker placement game in which you're acquiring books to put in your library, and you are trying to put them in alphabetical order and have shelf stability, that type of thing. The big difference is that these locations come out. You don't always get the same locations every game. But when they reprinted it, they changed them because they were very hard to read in the original. And certainly from across the table, that the font was small, or it was hard to read, or it was covered up. And this just made it a lot clearer of where things go. And
we'll have to play it again so I can potentially walk back my dirty looks that I gave you at a few moments ago.
Yeah, they just
we'll have to check it out.
Yeah, they changed some stuff that the abilities of each location are on each tile. There's no looking up, and there's no small text. They kind of divided it up, and it just one of the biggest complaints of the original game they addressed when they redid that. And I think it makes a big difference on that one. So that's my number three, Ex Libris.
Renegade Games?
Correct, yes.
Okay. I assumed it was just a cash grab. I'm glad you corrected me on that, and I'll give that second edition a look and a play. And
it was
great.
One that they went out of what more companies should do is it went out of print and then they revised it. Like, they just changed the things that they needed to do before they reprinted it again, which the amount of games that have something in the forums where people are complaining about, oh gosh, this should be better, this should be better. And it's like, just change that in the next printing, but companies.
Yeah. I really thought that was like a junk orbit where they just took the cylinder box and put in a cereal box.
No.
So it's good to hear that. Okay. That's good. See, I'm learning, folks. Good. All right, Scorn is taken back, possibly. where are we at here on the list? Two for me is a game we just talked about last week, Nemiji. I'm talking about it again because go back and listen last week if you didn't, but I really like the fishing and building the boat on Nemiji. It's just a few more choices. It's a re-implementation from Takedo. It's set in the Takedo universe. And for me, that's the one that I have in my collection. Obviously, completely subjective, but it is my list. And designer is Antoine Bauza, publisher is Funforge. So for me, that jumps all the way to two.
Cool. My number two is one that I'm surprised we haven't talked about, and we'll have a discussion off air because I felt like we had this on the schedule and maybe it just got pushed down. And some gamers are going to strongly disagree with me on this one, and that is Archaeos Society. Published by Space Cowboys and Paolo Mori. The original was Ethnos. It came out in 2017, and this version came out in 2023. And it did a couple of things. One is some people really like is it John Howe?
John Howe did the art on Ethnos,
which is a famous Lord of the Rings artist.
John Howe did not do the art on Archaeos Society.
He did not. I felt like that there was a disconnect between the gameplay, the art, and then the graphic design of the game of Ethnos. They changed it into Archaeos Society, which changed two things about it. One is it made it a game of racing up tracks instead of an area control game. And I'm usually not a fan of area control, it's one that I feel like I just don't like that competition. And Archaeos Society made it working up tracks and getting bonus points for it. It's a game in which you're trying to collect cards, and then you play a set of cards down, either of color or type, But then whatever you don't use in your set, you need to make available for everybody else. And so you're trying to push your luck to increase your set, but in doing so, you may be adding more stuff that you need to give away to other players. And I love that balance. I love the theming change that they did to it. Although I think thematically some of the original ones worked out better, kind of made more sense the way that you played the cards. But I do love the tracks and the artwork way better, getting that one out on the table. And so that's my number two, Arceus Society.
Oh, and that's awesome. Last week I thought about having Ethnos as original better, and that's where different games work for different people. And we need to talk about that game. I think why it got bumped off the list is I've only played it once, and I need a repeat of play to really be able to dig in and talk about it and look at what the skills are. Great, great call out. When did that one come out? Was it just last
2023.
Year?
2023. Yep.
Cool. So we've got some time.
We've got 10 years.
Yeah. Number one for me, this is the one that is just art. But I feel like the art and what they did with the game just really sets it apart from the original, and that's High Society. Mm. So I know I've got two Reiner games on my list, but you guys are lucky I don't have five games from Uncle Reiner with the amount of second and third editions. But High Society is a game that also plays at just 3 to 5 players, and the Osprey games is the version that I'm talking about. Unbelievable tension that is built in this little card game. Initially released in 1995. I'm struggling because I didn't come in prepared with when the High Society version that I have that I'm talking about was released. But the Osprey games takes a game from 1995 and just puts beautiful art onto the cards, and the game pops. And the unique factor, we've talked about this game a few times, but the unique factor about High Society is if you spend the most money, you lose. So it's a bidding game where you're trying to build out your hand and increase where you are in society, but you don't want to be the biggest striver in the group because you're going to be defeated automatically. And that's just a wonderful little Kenizia scoring mechanic put in there. But that's my number one is High Society.
2018, that version came out.
Thank you, Doug. Yep.
All right, my number one was a no-brainer for me, and that is Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition. The original came out in 2011, and the 2nd Edition came out in 2016 from Fantasy Flight Games and Nikki Valance. Mansions of Madness, the original version, let me backtrack. The 2nd Edition uses an app to run the game and kind of keep things going. And the original one was card-based, and you had to set up the deck beforehand and get everything ready. And if you put a card in the wrong spot, you can destroy the entire game. You can ruin it. And then that's based on the, you know, it's kind of one person is running the house and everybody else is playing the characters in it. Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition makes it entirely cooperative. The game tells you which tiles to put out as you're building the mansion, what monsters are out, and that level of running it, and it adds little puzzles into it, and just one of those first games that I think really implemented an app-based companion really well, that they then since have used that in the Lord of the Rings Journeys to Middle-earth, uses a similar type of system. And they used it to create a cooperative version for Descent Journeys in Dark, which that 2nd edition is also better than the original as well. But they got a lot of things right with Mansions of Madness, and a game that I love playing every once in a while, and you pull it out, and it's always an experience. So that's
great.
My number one, Mansions of Madness. The only one I had on my honorable mentions, and I didn't know how far of a stretch it was of whether this would be in the same family or not, but and if it was allowed, it would probably be pretty high on my list, and that's Funfair, which we talked about in episode 50, that re-implemented Unfair and took a lot of the take that and meanness out of the game and just made it a way more approachable game to play with a lot more people. So that would be pretty high on my list, but I didn't know where that line was of, is this a new game or an altered second edition? So,
yeah, good little list of games, though, and probably a list we could run back if we're still on the air in 4 or 5 years, because games continue to get refined, yeah, reimplemented, reintroduced, yep, right?
All right, any honorable mentions for you? Nope. Okay, so those are our high five second edition games. Let us know what you think should have been on the list or games that you appreciate the newer version of. You can subscribe to the podcast or follow us on X at GameSchoolerU. Join the Discord, gameschooler.com/Discord. Next week, we'll be talking about Fid to Print, making the first play a great experience for others, and our reworked games we'll be talking about next week. So thank you so much for spending the last hour or so with us. We truly appreciate it.
Now get out there and keep gaming.